Good afternoon. Welcome to the Institute of International Relations. My name is Rudolf Fest. I'm the research fellow here, and it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce here Professor Ming Chu Chen. Professor Ming is a well-known political scientist from Taiwan. Currently, he is based at the National Taiwan University. He is the chairman of the Department of Political Science.
Was.
Okay. No more?
No longer.
Okay, I'm happy to say. To update my dates, I'm sorry for that.
That's right.
But as to the past, Professor Ming was a member of an advisory committee on the governmental level, at first to the president, in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and as well as in the Mainland Affairs Council. That's right. Professor Ming deals with the theory of international relations, studies the contemporary Chinese affairs, both in mainland China and in Taiwan, studies the China-Taiwan cross-strait relations, and also conducts research in the field of the contemporary development of mainland Chinese society. Today, Professor Ming will focus on the analysis of situation in mainland China and on the prospect for democratization. So, actually, this is the first ever presentation of Professor Ming in the Czech Republic, in Prague.
So actually, it's my first visit.
Yes, your first visit. So I think this is, for us, it's very rare and enjoyable opportunity. So we may be looking forward to hear the lecturing of Professor Ming. And after that, we will have opportunity for a discussion. So, please.
First, I would like to thank Mr. Fust for the very kind introduction. And I'm very glad and proud to have this opportunity to meet with you, to share with you some of my observations and assessments of what's going on in mainland China, with particular respect to the possibility or the prospect of democratization in that society. I think it's a question of much concern all over the world by now, especially when China is rising economically and also militarily. So people are wondering where China is going from here. And especially as a neighbor, or as a little brother of this big China, Taiwan is where I'm from. And this question of major concern for us. For you, this question of international relations or an economic question, for us is a matter of life and death. So we pay a different magnitude of attention to the issue, which will be kind of different. But at any rate, I'm very happy to be here to share some with you. I think that for both Taiwan and Czech, despite the fact that we have very different tradition, cultural background, and the path we've been gone through in the past, but the important thing is, or something which is in common is, we both have democratized. And democracy in both systems are pretty much consolidated. But for the consolidation of democracy, I personally noticed that there is something called the factor of external environment, which could play a role in determining whether the democracy in a given society will be viable or not. For Taiwan, this external factor, or this factor of external environment, would have to do with two things. First is the development of mainland China, that is the future of China. And second is the interactions or the exchanges across the Taiwan Strait. But because the time is rather limited today, so I think I'm gonna concentrate on only one issue, namely the development of mainland China. There are several things, or there are several ways to cut into this thing, but I think because the time is limited, so I think I'm going to start with a very important, a brief but important observation about the possibility of China's future in terms of political development. So it seems to me that there are several possibilities. One is the top-down democratization effort started by the government or by the ruling party or by the ruling elite. That's one possibility. And the other one is what we call the bottom-up efforts, such as what happened here in Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia back then, in 1989, or in other countries, such as what we call the Color Revolution. And of course, we have to admit that there is another alternative, the third alternative, namely a violent and non-peaceful transformation, or rebellion, or whatever, in a given society. So I think I'm going to start from there. Let me try to briefly define what we're talking about in terms of top-down democratization, color revolution, or what? Top-down revolution or top-down democratization, that means it's a democratizing effort initiated, again, like I said, by the government or by the ruling elite or by the ruling party. There are numerous examples here by now. So at least we can bring up at least two. One is where I'm from, Taiwan. The other one is Spain in the 1980s again. And the second possibility is what we call color revolution. It's basically a bottom-up effort of democratization. And it's basically peaceful and relatively bloodshed-free. I'm not saying that there'll be no bloodshed whatsoever, but in comparison, there's a few bloodshed or very much bloodshed involved in the process. So that's what we call the color revolution. For example, what happened in Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan, or some people say that the Silk Revolution here in Czechoslovakia in 1989. So I took the liberty of expanding the term or the idea of color revolution to cover cases prior to the 1990s. So even back to what happened in the late 1980s. But what I'm trying to stress here is it's peaceful and it's basically bloodshed-free. That's what we call color revolution. And then the third part, or what? Usually people will skip that because they would treat it as a residual category. But it seems to me, in the Chinese case, this or what category is in point. So what exactly do I mean by or what? Here's what it is. A violent rebellion or revolution involving much conflict, involving much bloodshed. For instance, the traditional peasant rebellion in Chinese history, which has been plaguing our history for more than 2,000 years. So this is the or what route. Up to this point, I'm sure that in your mind, you have made your judgment. You must have said that, oh, I like this one better and I don't like that one. But we know that societal changes or the changes of political systems may not go according to our subjective wishes. If that's the case, then rebellions or revolutions will never happen. Or at least violent ones will never happen. But that's not the case. So all we have to do is, or all we can do at the point of time is we just look at what information or what phenomena we have so far in hand and try to go from there and see what might happen in the future for the Chinese case. So much for the definition. In China, we all know that the reform, ever since Deng Xiaoping started in 1978, by now there has been 32 years. And admittedly, they have made some progress in spheres like economy. And in terms of the society or social changes, the society itself is much more complicated than it was 32 years ago, because it has become an industrialized and commercialized system to a certain extent. Although there are reservations to the point of how much the question of marketization has taken root in that society, but we have to admit that compared to what it was 32 years ago, the society itself is much more complicated than before. And as for the political aspect, although people have been telling me that there are great changes in China in terms of politics. I studied Chinese politics half of my life, and I noticed the changes. And we've been advising political elites from mainland China as to how to learn from other countries and other systems and try to adjust and try to take the good parts back to the Chinese system so that you can take a smoother road. But somehow they are either too coward or either too risk averse as to the point that they don't want to try it. So although there are some good hopes and goodwill, but I'm not sure that all the good hope and goodwill will materialize in the future. So we just keep on working on that. But the point is, the political aspect remains pretty much the same, except for one thing. The strength of the political control does slacken to a large extent, and they don't exercise so-called a class struggle in a massive scale anymore compared to what happened during the Mao Zedong time. And ever since Deng Xiaoping, they seldom do that. And Jiang Zemin did it once or twice, and now down in the Hu Jintao time, and by now it's almost 7 years, we haven't seen much of that kind of things happening. So I suppose it's fair to say that the strength of the political control has been slackened to a certain point. But then the question remains. That is, the social change. Like I said, the Chinese society has changed a lot. It has changed greatly ever since it turned this into an industrialized and commercialized system, or commercialized society. It's becoming more and more complicated. And these are the things, or these are the factors, that may affect the future development of the society, as I see it. Before I get into the details, allow me to say this first. Out of the six aspects here described, five of them are admitted publicly or semi-publicly by the Chinese government itself. The Chinese government remains silent on one out of these six factors. I'll point out which one later on. So what I'm saying is, I basically draw these observations or assessments from the Chinese sources, from the official Chinese sources, to make my analysis more credible and more logical. What I have done so far is just put together what the Chinese government has been saying here and there, and put them into one picture, try to piece them into one big picture, and hopefully they can shed more lights on the future of the Chinese society. Although the six major factors affecting the development of Chinese future in terms of its societal development, I think I'll go with the last one first, because it comes from a different category. It's easier for me to handle this one, and then I'll go back to the other five, because they come in a more logical fashion. Okay, the last point. Point number six is environmental and ecological problems they're facing. Now they're talking about air pollution, water pollution, disappearance of plantations, sand dust, desertization, and depletion of water resources. These are the six major environmental as well as ecological problems they're facing, admitted by the Chinese government itself. Because of the limit of the time, I don't want to get into details. All I want to do is just show you a few pictures just to illustrate the point. I'm sure you are familiar with this picture. That's what happened prior to the Beijing Olympic. Again, prior to the Beijing Olympic. And on the left-hand side is Beijing at noontime, and the right-hand side is Shenyang, a Manchurian city at noontime. Again, prior to the Olympic game time. This is water pollution by the a kind of a bacteria, they call it a green-blue bacteria, affecting the water. It's quite common all over China. And this is Qingdao. It's not a lawn. It's the water. flooded by that kind of bacteria. So it looks like a carpet of lawn, but actually not. And that's the place for the Olympic Games. So they literally send the military to clean up the field just for the yacht race. And that's what happened after the 1958 greatly forward. They cut down trees to burn and to try to produce both steel and iron. But what's left is the depletion of plantation. And it's quite common. And what comes with this depletion of plantation is sandus. I'm sure for those who have visited China, especially northern China, during summertime and autumn time, it's pretty much like that. And that's Beijing too. And that's a picture from. Move it down a little bit. I want to show. I'm not sure I can do it right. I want to show that little airplane. Oh yeah, there we go. That little airplane down there. It's flying toward Beijing. So that means how far the desert has been growing toward Beijing. They estimate about 20 or 30 years from now, Beijing will be covered by sand, be part of the desert. Depends on how much effort they put into to prevent it. But the challenge itself is quite great. And depletion of water resources. And that's Yellow River. It's Yellow River. It happened in history, and that's again, that's the official photo. By the Xinhua net, as you can see. Okay, so much for the ecological and environmental problems. Now, to the first point. The widening gap between the rich and the poor. Based on official statistics, the urban countryside gap, the gap between the city and the countryside, officially speaking, about 5 years ago, it's like a 3.51. But if we look at the figures given by the government about 3-4 years ago, it grew to a worsening 6.1. And now it grows to an alarming rate by the time of February 2008, by one of the official magazine, Liao Wang. Some people translate it as Outlook. It says the average largest gap between the rich and poor, between the city and the countryside amounts to 21.5 times. So that means there's a drain of labor from the countryside. That means most younger people, strong people, will flee the countryside, pour into the city, which caused an irreversible trend of urbanization, and which caused major problems like unemployment, or housing, education, transportation, garbage, and even crime rate, things like that. And another way to measure that would be the Gini coefficient, as you are all aware of. The figure I give here is official and also semi-official. 0.45, which signifies the possibility or even the probability of a class struggle or class war in the Chinese society, is 0.45, and that's the official figure. For those who have been following the Chinese literature in the related area closely, you will know that the Chinese scholars are debating the meaning or the implication of this 0.5 mean. Some say, oh, well, China is different, so 0.45 doesn't mean that we're going to have a class war. That's what happened in Latin America in the 1980s or the 1990s, because we're Chinese, we're different. And some say, well, it's a warning, meaning that we may be stepping down the path of having a class warfare. So this kind of debate is going on pretty enthusiastically among the scholars. The 0.5 figure was given by the deputy director of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences about 2 years ago. So that's an alarming figure, indicating that the gap between the rich and poor is ever increasing. And we're not sure that what the government can do about it, although they notice it and they try to subsidize the countryside in various ways, but the natural imbalances is still there. So it's hard to reverse the trend as far as we are concerned so far. And there are other ways to look at it. For instance, the Aihun Tengchong line, the line that divides China into two parts, the southwestern part, the southeastern part, and the northwestern part. These are two different worlds, actually. For the southern part, we see a concentration of population, we see a concentration of job opportunities, we see a concentration of income and everything. And for the other part, it's just quite the opposite. So they don't know how to reverse the trend. And what's important, what's interesting to notice that the line here, here's the Aihun County, and here's the Tengchong County. If you draw a line between these two cities, the line, this imaginary line, will move downward 100 meters per year. 100 meters per year. Okay. The trend has been going on for more than 20, 30 years. So that means the Chinese government's effort to disperse the population, the Chinese population, hasn't been as successful as they have wished for so many years. So there must be much tougher measures to be taken if they really want to reverse the trend. I've been joking. I said, okay, for another 200 years, the line will reach the point of Taiwan Strait. Then we'll be in big trouble. But that'll be 200 years away from now, theoretically speaking. So point number two, corruption. Corruption had been in the Chinese society for quite some time, and it became worse and worse ever since the 1980s. But ever since the year of 2000, it's becoming alarmingly dangerous. After 2001, according to the official figure offered by the Public Security Department, it says, we have reviewed and caught more than 40,000 cases per year after year 2001. And for the amount of money involved in each case, for those cases over 1 million RMB, renminbi, it's like equivalent to 120,000 euro, and it's roughly equivalent to an average family income of a Chinese family of three for more than 80 years. So you're talking about a huge amount of money involved in each case of corruption. And these are the official figures. By the year of 1993, altogether 57 cases were reviewed and caught, busted. And by the year of 2000, 1,335 cases were busted. After 2001, each year we have uncovered more than 1,300 cases. We're talking about mega money involved. So who are these people who are being busted or caught? This is the director of the what we call the FDA in the United States, Food and Drug Administration, or agency. He happened to stumble over the issue of the poisoned milk. You remember that? A couple years back? And he was the scapegoat for that issue. And this gentleman is the director of the Attorney General of Tianjin City, the fourth largest city in China, a very famous one. An even more famous figure is this gentleman, who was the real head, the real guy behind Shanghai City, Chen Liang, and he's also famous. And an even higher guy is the vice president of their National People's Congress, just like your parliament here. He's the deputy head. And this guy is a major figure. For his case, it involved 80 billion RMB, a money you can never imagine. He's now in Canada. They tried to extradite him, but they're still working on the case. To the right-hand side in Chinese, it says that the high officials involved in the case, for instance, the deputy minister of the public security, or the deputy director of Fujian province, the deputy mayor of Sanan city, and also some public security people. I have here with me a figure, again, official figure. Out of 1.4 billion Chinese people, these are the rich people, people with personal assets over 50 million RMB, there are 27,310 people. It's a small handful. And if we double the personal assets to 100 million RMB, now we're looking at a little bit more than 3,000 people. What is worth noting is out of these a little bit over 3,000 people, we're talking about 91 to 92% of them are either the high cadres themselves or the families from the high cadres. So-called the privileged class. And that's, again, released by the government source in April 2006. They haven't updated this information because it's very damaging. So I doubt that they would do that. And here I have with me a partial list of the corrupted officials who fled the country with money. You see the names and also the position they held when they were busted, and the amount of money, and also the place they flee to. So it's in all in Chinese. I don't have the time to translate all that. It's a partial list. And the third aspect, or the third factor that may affect the future development of the Chinese society is the civil disobedience, also what we call a social unrest. If we put it more specifically, we call it civil government conflicts. According to the official statement, the major source or the major reasons for this kind of conflict would arise from first, land enclosure. It takes about 90% of the cases. And unemployment about 5%, and judicial injustice another 5%. So that makes up the 100% there. So what we're looking at is land enclosure will be the primary sources for civil unrest, so for the social unrest. Or sometimes we see that the crackdown on religions or beliefs, such as Falun Gong case or the Christianity case. Altogether, according to incomplete statistics released by the government itself, so far there are more than 10 million cases of appeals. People who felt they've been unjustly treated, either judicially or politically, they'll go over to Beijing to appeal their cases. There are more than 10 million cases. And again, like I said, for the civil uprisings, more than 90% of them comes from land enclosure. And the Chinese government knows about it very well, so they prepare for a crackdown ever since a long time ago. And since 2003, since Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao stepped into office, they made several preparations, which was different from what they did before. First one is to set up the counter-uprising points in 36 major cities all over China. But 1 or 2 years later, they decided that was not enough. So they began to work on the so-called legal preparation for military crackdown. And they have actual policy guidelines for that. And the policy guideline was eventually made into law, and it was adopted in 2005, or 2006 rather. And then I'm going to show you some of the pictures from the what I call the social unrest. This is what they call the village for the upheavers in Beijing. For those who have visited Beijing, is to the southern part, to the southern suburb of Beijing. All you have to do is to, I don't remember which route of the bus you should take. I think it's a bus route 38 or something. Do you remember? Probably less than 1 hour away from the center of Beijing. Oh, actually, 45 minutes away from the center of Beijing, then you'll see those people. They'll be cleaned out from time to time. If there's a major event happening in Beijing, they'll be cleaned out. But pretty soon they'll come back again, because they have to come here to appeal their cases. So the gentleman to the right with a camera in his hand is the photographer from an official newspaper, Wang Huibao. These are the appealers. Once they hear, they think there's an opportunity for their cases to be heard, they'll come over to appeal to whoever that might want to listen. For instance, if you dress up and if you look like somebody, you go there, people see you as a foreigner, they'll come appeal to you. You can try it. Just like that. You may run the risk of being driven by the Chinese government, and you'll be deported and never be allowed into China. But if you show obedience, you'll probably get a second chance. But chances are, you're going to come across them. This is a picture of crackdown on Falun Gong case back in 1999. Falun Gong is a very peaceful way of cultivation. You can see them all over the world. But the Chinese government has a serious doubt about them, because Falun Gong people believe in God, and the Chinese government or the Chinese communists are atheists. So according to them, there is an ideological conflict between the two. So they want to crack them down. Same as they crack down on Christianity or Catholicism and other religious groups. And that's the Falun Gong case. And that's what happened in the Hubei province. Some chef got into a conflict with another guy, and the guy was protected by the local police, and they got into trouble, and then burned down the house, and then it broke into a riot to the point of overthrowing the police car, as you can see here. And that's how they tried to crack down in this Hubei case. And that's a Guangdong case in 2005. It's a very famous one. That's the very first one they use military to crack down harshly, and then even use tanks. That's the very first case after the 1989 Tiananmen massacre. Numerous people were killed. We don't have the exact figure. There was a Japanese news team sent into the site and tried to interview and tried to write the story, but the photographer was pointed down to the ground with a gun pointed at his head, and all the stuff were confiscated. But the Japanese reporter was experienced enough that he had the hollow shoes. So he hit something, a roll of film, inside the shoe. And he smuggled out that film so that we could see something. And then with the help of internet circumvention devices, we get to see more. But that's one of the pictures sent out. And that's the pictures of the conflict in various cases. And this is what happened in Shenyang in 2007. 2007 Shenyang. And this is what happened in Guizhou in 2008. A young girl was raped and killed, and the murderer was protected by the policeman because the murderer himself was probably the son of the local police chief. Look at the people who are trying to overthrow the car, the police car. That's your public security police car. These are kids under the age of 14. oddly enough. They burned down the police station. This is a Uyghur case in 2009. Again, Uyghur case, Xinjiang case. And that's the wives of those who were detained by the government. Okay. Again, official statistics. According to the Public Security Department, is that these are the number of cases happened involving the so-called civil government conflict or civil uprising. It says in the year 2000, there are altogether 10,000 cases. By 2003, it rose to 58,000 cases. By 2004, it rose to 74,000 cases in one single year. By 2005, it's 87,000 years. I had a TV program myself, so I cite these figures often enough, and I do analysis. And I even challenged the Public Security Department of mainland China, said, give me more information. I can tell the world what's going on here. So these are the simple thing I did. He said, altogether, let me make one important definition. What exactly we mean by a social unrest? Just how does a case constitute a social unrest case? By the official definition, if there are more than 100 people involving in attacking the policemen or government officials, that will count one incident. Okay, more than 100. If there are only 99 people, then that case will be dismissed. Okay. So with that strict definition, we're looking at 87,000 cases in 1 year alone. So what do we mean by 87,000 cases in 1 year? Divide up by 365 days per year, we're looking at 240 cases per day involving more than 100 people attacking policemen or government officers or government offices. If we divide up by 30 provinces, we're looking at least 8 cases per province per day. Let me ask you this. How many cases of that magnitude ever happened in Czechoslovakia since 1989? Now you know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. You say China is a populous country, so it should have things of a different magnitude. But try to multiply by your population. You know what that means. So who knows these things best? Government officials. So what are their policies? The official policy is to crack down or to smooth it out one way or another, or to buy off people sometimes. They do use money to buy off people. Okay, stop quarreling because I'm going to pay for it. Okay. And personally, they take a different way. They take a different approach. They try to flee the country. And again, these are the official figures. From 1988 to the year of 2002, we're looking at more than at least 4,000 people who are bureau chief up, higher than that. Let me explain what do we mean by bureau chief. For the government agencies, we have minister. Ministry with minister. We have deputy minister. The level below deputy minister or deputy secretary, we're looking at bureau chief. Now, am I making myself clear enough? Bureau chief, I don't mean bureau chiefs of central governments. According to their statistics, they are talking about bureau chiefs of local as well central as well as local governments. So some of the local governments aren't as high as you imagine, but still, that's high enough. That's high enough. So officially they say, yes, in between those 15 years, we're talking about at least 4,000 people with that kind of status who fled the country. And how much money have they been stealing since then? the official figure, the official initial official figure was $50 billion. We're talking about billion U.S. dollars. And then the number began to grow and grow and grow, and eventually Liao Wang, again, the official magazine who admitted in 2006, it says, yes, at least 4,000 high-ranking countries fled the country, who has stolen altogether a U.S. dollars of 191.4 billion U.S. dollars, which is equivalent to one-third of the total foreign direct investment for the past 32 years, ever since 1978. And the Central Organization Department of the Party says altogether there are 1.1 million family and family members who emigrated to other countries from China. 1.1 million. That includes those who fled to, those who emigrated to Hong Kong and Macau. They consider that semi-foreign, although it is part of their SAR, Special Administrative Regions. And they have done something to stop the trend. They try to catch those people, catch those bad guys according to their definition. And that's again the official figure. From 1998 to 2006, the Anti-Corruption Bureau of the Highest Protectorate Office is that we have captured more than 70 people out of those 4,000. It's a very discouraging figure, but that's the official figure. And they came across that kind of figure accidentally. They did not really do a research on that subject. The whole thing was revealed, was exposed to the public by this gentleman, who was a professor, and as you can see, as you can read from the Chinese, who's an economist, who worked for the Commerce Department, who was a researcher actually, who also worked as an adjunct professor in the Beijing University of Post Office and Electricity. He did a research on the foreign direct investment inside China, and who stumbled across those cases. So he wrote a separate report in addition to the one he contracted from the government. So he came across those things. That was quite scary. Oh, by the way, he has his own blog, if you want to read it, if you can read Chinese. And he has on his blog. He revealed different sources of information, and some of them are very alarming and very helpful for us. I imagine that he might get into trouble sometime. He's a very outspoken person, so I can only bid him good luck in that kind of system. Point number five, the one which is not publicly admitted by the Chinese government, but which I think is the most important one, is the disintegration of the ruling party, the CCP. Beginning in late 2004 and growing stronger and stronger ever since early 2005, there is a such movement called Renouncing the CCP, the Youth Corps, and Young Pioneer, the Communist Young Pioneer. It was, how should I call it? It was ignited, accidental ignition, by the publication of some articles in the newspaper, which is called the Epoch Times. And then the Epoch Times gathered these editorials and to publish the book, and that's the name of the book, The Nine Commentaries on the Communist Party. For us, outside of, well, I'm sure some of you have the experience of living under communist rule, but for those who've been living under Chinese communism, who knew nothing about the outside world, and who knew nothing about the bias consistent in the textbook of their communist education, so they knew nothing aside from the official propaganda line. So these nine commentaries are something which is rather different from what they've been preaching in the past. So to them, to the Chinese readers, these commentaries opened up their eyes open up to something they never knew, they could never think of, they could never imagine. So here's the trend. Beginning, let me point to the diagram here. Beginning in December 2004, there are altogether 2,500 people who denounced the CCP. And then the next month, January 2005, more than 4,500 people who left the party. And then 60,000, 400,000, 600,000, and then up and down, up and down, by the month, all the way up to now, present time. So altogether, we're looking at the total of 83 million people who claim to leave these three organizations. One of the three, or two of the three, or all three of them. Here's the source. CCP means the Chinese Communist Party, YC means Youth League, YP means Young Pioneer, and here's the source, http://tuidang.com. Again, I cited these figures in my program. My experience is that if I say something really nasty and they really hate me, they refuse me in one or two occasions. Sometimes I see that in their official newspapers. Some I got the words from different ways to get to me. And some come in emails, and some in the faxes, and some in letters, all sorts of forms. But for this thing, they never touch upon the subject. Means that's something really serious. I'm sure you know much about, you know as much communism as I do, or the Communist Party as much as I do, which is a tightly grit institution or organization. It's almost like, how shall I call it? The underground world. If you try to rebel against it, they'll chase after you for the rest of your life. So is Chinese Communist Party. So quitting the party or renouncing the party membership, either using a real name or using an apron name, that's just like a rebellion to them. So they hunt you down. And I got the very solid proof of how they hunt down these people. And I interviewed one of the people who hunt down these people, who then fled to Australia and asked for political asylum, who work as one of the leading political officers in Tianjin City. And in 2004, 2005, all of a sudden his conscience woke up, and then he decided to flee to the outside world. And that's how he revealed the story. Part of the story to substantiate the other part of my story here. So far, I haven't heard any refutation from them officially. So I'm very eager to listen to what they have to say about this. So to me, that's the most important thing. Because as you all know, for any communist system, it is the Communist Party that counts. It's that 5% of the political elite who try to control the entire society, the rest 95% of the population. So they have to, the party itself would have to be very elitist. So-called the chosen few, the 5% of chosen few of the total population. For the Chinese Communist Party, this party has been strong, well-disciplined, organized, and ready to fight. This party even survived the 1989 Tiananmen massacre and the purge afterwards. But facing this book, or facing these nine commentaries, is falling apart. So that's really something important, and that's something they really don't want to touch upon publicly. Here's the trend. For the first 10 million, it took 17 months to reach. For the second million, it took a year. Third and fourth, less than 1 year. And I noticed this thing for several years. And I remember 2 years ago when I was here visiting a a group of German scholars, as well as some other European scholars, when I mentioned this thing, I said, you know what, Dr. Ming, we saw similar things happening in Eastern European countries and Soviet Union before they disintegrate. So we're not saying that, oh, they're doomed for sure. What we're saying is, their most powerful controlling tool, the instrument for ruling, is now falling apart. And that's a very serious signal to us. Oh, here's the gentleman. He was the high cadre of the Tianjin City, the National Security Safeguard Bureau, who fled to Australia. This is a press conference he gave in Taiwan, when he toured Taiwan. Okay, so what does that amount to? What does all that amount to? As I pointed out at the very beginning, we're looking at three possibilities, or three different paths. First one is top-down democratization. It has much to do with the elite's attitude. So far we have seen many people, high-ranking officials, who are opposed to democratization. So they don't want to have anything to do with it whatsoever. And the official line being that first we see a official white paper issued in the year of 2005. The title of the white paper is something like Construction of Democratic Politics in China. And another one, related one, was issued in 2007, which is called Politicals. I was half asleep. System. Political party system, talking about the possibility of having a political, a democratic political system. But they reverse, or they transcend the true meaning of party system. They turn it into a one-party dictatorship, and they try to legitimate it. And Hu Jintao talked about, openly voices opposition against the separation of powers. And the heir apparent, Xi Jinping, said similar things in Hong Kong, in Tianjin, and also in when he was visiting a foreign country about 6 months ago, he openly criticized the possibility of having a separation of power into three. So namely, he's opposed it. He opposes it. But we see one dissident voice, the current premier, Wen Jiabao. If our record is correct, then he's been talking about political reforms and democracy and freedom of speech about 6 to 7 times for the past 40 days. So that leads us to wonder why and how. There are several possibilities. If what he says represents what the top leaders are thinking, then according to the Chinese tradition, Chinese communist tradition, it should be followed up by overwhelming promotion of propaganda and everything. But so far, we haven't seen anything aside from what Wen Jiabao has said. And second, we haven't seen any concrete moves being taken by the government. And thirdly, that leads us to wonder, is that a sign of possible political struggle? Wen Jiabao is saying that to protect himself in advance. He knows that he will be stepping down next year or even earlier. And he knows that they won't be easy on him. He might be facing some unpredictable problems or challenges. But he knows also for sure that democracy will come in China. So he's investing in advance. He's trying to say something in advance to protect himself. Yes, I will be purged physically. But in the end, when China democratizes, my name will be cited. That's my analysis. Well, it remains to be seen in the future. So we're pushing toward the end of making a conclusion here. Color revolution. given the fact that we have mentioned so many factors of social unrest, be them a corruption or social disobedience or quitting the party and things like that, yes, there is a possibility for color revolution, meaning a peaceful transformation toward democracy. And that seems to be a good bet, a best bet. But I'm not sure that's what we're going to get in China. Then comes the or what part. That's what I said. Are we witnessing the coming of a peasant revolution? Or a massive civil uprising against the existing government? Or what? Now the last point to the last. Will there be any external factors at play in this whole process? Taiwan could certainly play a role. The United States could. The United States did play a role in this part of the world 20 years ago. And there's no reason the United States would not step in. And there's a chance. But the question is, would they dare by then? We don't know. So I guess what I would say is, let's prepare for the worst, yet hope for the best. And that concludes my observation. Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you very much to Professor Ming for his dark review of the Chinese society. Anyway, we have just about 15 minutes for your questions, so please be so kind and take this opportunity. Please don't forget to introduce your name and your institution. Thank you very much. So, first questions? Anyway, maybe you may think it over, so I will ask first. Actually, I'm wondering when the first book of Professor Ming will be available on the Chinese bookshops. But let me ask you, was the democracy a benefit for the ill Chinese society? Can the democracy and the legalized opposition and free media bring about some basic progress for this situation?
May or may not, actually. Democracy doesn't cure everything. It's not a panacea. But I talk to Germans all the time. The German scholars and the average people whom I met in the street, Berlin, Hamburg, and everywhere. Some people regretted the unification. But I said, okay, if you regret about the unification, do you regret about democratization? None of them say yes. So they are all for democratization, but not necessarily for unification. So that means that democracy does not cure everything, but this is something good, something valuable to it, intrinsic to it. I think it's especially meaningful for us to talk about this topic here in Prague. In Taiwan, our generation have gone through the authoritarian rule, although it wasn't as bad as what we are looking at. But we didn't feel quite comfortable. And I always want to have a larger room to speak. And I always wonder if I say something dangerous, will I be caught at night? Will the policeman will come to my door and knock at my door and try to catch me and throw me behind bars at night? That kind of worries always linger behind my mind, but not anymore. So I think, in the end, I would say democracy is a good thing, but it may not cure everything. And another point, derivative from this is, like it or not, it's going to come. So what I'm saying is, I'm predicting it's coming, but I'm not saying that it will cure anything or everything. It might cure something. So I'm not 100% optimistic about what democracy could bring to a certain society. sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But it's kind of fun.
Yes, sir,
please.
Jan Schinagel, Internet Online News. Mr. Mink, can you tell us, do you have any problems about your activities with Chinese secret services or police?
What do you mean? Any problem?
And you can you are able to work free, all free, no
in
problem.
Taiwan.
No.
In Taiwan,
in
no
Taiwan,
problem.
And no problem.
No problem at all. No.
Okay.
But I have trouble with mainland China. They wouldn't allow me in. I applied for visa several times. I got rejected.
You have never been in China?
I've been in China many times. But ever since I got more and more famous, they reject me.
And last time in China?
Last time in it was 2003 or 2004. I can't quite remember. And I remember it was 2004, 2005, I don't quite remember. I got a problem entering into Hong Kong. My mother was born there in Hong Kong. My mother got the Hong Kong ID, Hong Kong ID card. And I got a problem entering into Hong Kong. And I had no problem entering into Hong Kong whatsoever prior to 1997. Last time I was detained in Hong Kong airport for 2 hours. I made a phone call to my local friends, and I heard that more than 20 calls pouring into the Hong Kong customs asking that, why are you detaining Dr. Meng? We all know him. We know he's a decent man. He's a professor. He won't cause any trouble such as national security trouble for you. Mm-hmm. So why are you detaining him? Mm-hmm. And I asked him, why are you detaining me? They said, we don't know.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Some more questions?
My name is Victoria Potokin. I'm an intern here at the Institute, and I come from a post-Soviet country and a recent color revolution country from the Ukraine. So I was actually able to draw a few parallels with your presentation to what's going on in my country. And the main thing I wanted to ask you is there a opposition leader being prepared? Because unless you have a new leaders, new people to replace the old regime, a revolution cannot happen, in essence. You cannot have a peasant revolution without someone stepping up and leading them. And a color revolution, in essence, is pointless if you have the same politicians replacing the old ones, if they're sort of staying there, but just calling themselves differently. So is there someone in China ready to step up and take that position? And my second question concerns the statistics of the uprisings. Do you have any comparisons to some Asian countries, maybe? Because maybe the case is different with Europe. Obviously, Czech Republic itself is a very small country, so, and generally one with a more or less peaceful history. But what about Asian countries? Is there available statistics for that? Or like, is China really unique in the uprisings?
Okay, I'll go straight to the second question first. The answer is no. Simple as that. We don't have any figure for the comparison purpose. Because for most of the authoritarian regimes, they take these figures like that. It's a very rare occasion that I come across that kind of statistics. One more note to the question. I was attending an academic conference in Taiwan, and there were scholars from mainland China and also Chinese scholars from abroad who attended that conference, and I cited those figures, and one guy was staring at me like that. I said, well, that guy must be from mainland China. He doesn't like what I said. So I better be careful with him. He might raise some tough questions, and I better be careful. And out of nowhere, he raised his hand and said, Dr. Ming, I want to challenge your figure. I said, please go ahead.
is that, you know what, I'm Mr. So-and-so, and I got my PhD in sociology in such and such United States, American universities. I've been teaching in American university, and I've been returning to China because that's where I'm from, and try to work on some projects and in association with what you call the Public Security Department. Let me tell you this, the figure you got are all wrong. It's less than half of the true figure I got from the Public Security Department. I begged him for the figures. He wouldn't give me, understandably. Understandably. So no basis for comparison. But I was shocked to hear that. Okay, now let's answer to the second question. For the first question, that's very important. Now we're in Czech Republic. Back in 1989 to 1991, altogether we have witnessed 9 communist regimes which collapsed, right? Okay. How many of them did have a ready-made opposition there? 3. Plus 1, Albania, 3.5, right? But they all transformed eventually, with or without a ready-made opposition. So that leads to my second question. Then where do the next generation of leaders really come from? Inside the Communist Party. Some of them come forward and take off the communist shirt and say, look, I'm no longer communist, I'm a Democrat from now on, from this day on. And he'll step up and then take over power. People will love him. So what I'm saying is, it does not necessarily take a ready-made opposition movement to have that kind of social change.
Okay, thank you. Some more questions, please?
What does it mean if the Communist Party fall down in China? What does it mean for communist officials? Your opinion?
Okay, again, back to the East European and Soviet cases. How many cases out of those 9 cases did we envision or did we witness a total breakdown of the system? Probably 1, Yugoslavia. And for the rest, there are bloodshed to a different degree. Right? But for the total disintegration of the system, of the society, there was only 1 case. Using those cases as a reference point may be risky, but that's something we could, this is our starting point. So what I'm saying is, we may be witnessing, for the Chinese case in the future, we may witness a possible concave of the party and of the government itself, but not necessarily a total collapse of the society or of the social system. Again, let's prepare for the worst, but hope for the best. There's no way that I can answer that question. I can only give you my guess and educate you.
I want to more focus this question.
Sure.
I think about they made many crimes, the Communist Party, and in this case, what do you mean? What happens to this, I don't know, certain person who made their crimes? Are they now, do they fear of foreign of regime and what they are doing? Maybe they are waiting or preparing.
They are worried. They are afraid of what might happen to them. Like I said, there are several ways to deal with that personally. One way is to buy a passport, buy a foreign passport. And the Chinese government noticed that, so they asked for a surrender of extra passports. I think the deadline came in earlier this year, I don't remember exactly when. It was like a June or May or something. Altogether, all the Chinese cadres hand out an average 3.5 passports for one person. You get it? You following me? How many passports do you have?
One?
Yeah. Anyone have more than two? They may be too sensitive, right? But for these Chinese officials, they have up to, on average, 3.5 passports for different countries. Now you're following me? They buy passports from different countries just for the future, just to for the uncertainty. So that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is it's a little bit, that's a penetrating question, I have to admit. So I have to sit up to answer that question. You ever heard of the name called the naked official? Naked official. In Chinese it's called luo guan. What does that mean? That means that the official himself is working in China all by himself. All his family, including his wife, his father, the mother, and kids, and everyone, they all moved out. But no one knows it. He was the only one working there. Why is he still working there? He's the source for income, a very good source for income, including corruption, of course. So he will be there working all by himself. But the rest of the family have emigrated, as shown in the figure, 1.1 million. So that's another way to look at it. So they are afraid, and that also leads to our previous observation, one of the previous observations. They don't want to let go of their power, and that's what causes the trouble for democratization. We've been talking to them to the point of preaching to them, but they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't listen. We say, according to our case in Taiwan, for the KMT, for the ruling Kuomintang, our experience is that the earlier you give up power, the earlier you democratize the system, the better off you are. Because the less crime you will commit, less likely you'll be chased after the change of hand of power. They understand the reason, they understand the rationale behind it, but they just wouldn't want to do it. There are many, many reasons to it, but personal consideration would be one of them. Yeah, any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I ask one question back to the social aspect you mentioned before. Do you have an idea about the proportion of these social unrest, like from which social classes they come? Because I'm
peasants.
Always impressed
peasants.
That... Yeah.
Peasants.
Yeah. But like if you want to overthrow a certain system or party, perhaps you need the higher classes protesting, like peasants, although they still account for most of the society, but still they are only they are the lower class. So how many protests are there in the middle or higher classes?
Very few. Like I said, that's according again to the official statistics, 90% of them come from land. So it's from peasants. So the peasants, the movement of the peasants will not last long until they're supported, joined and supported by intellectuals. Now, what are the intellectuals are doing? They are banned from having access to the peasants, especially in these cases. But we do see, in cases like these, we do see the participation of some intellectuals, some brave intellectuals. But they were greatly sought after by the government afterwards. Well, let's take a good example as Liu Xiaobo, the gentleman who just received the Nobel Peace Award, who's now thrown in jail. And why was he thrown in jail? They made up some very strange charge against him. But in the end, he was actually the person who started the Charter 08, which is an imitation of Charter 77. And I think that's a great idea. And at the very beginning, the Charter 08 gathered a little bit more than 300 signatures all over China. And by now it has gathered more than 3,000 signatures all over the world. but still.
Very little,
in a populous country like China. So that's a tiny proportion of the population which is now advocating as a dissident voice, but without having the possibility, without having the opportunity to join hands with the uprising peasants. So we see that. So that's why the Chinese government is so quick in cracking down the social uprising. Whenever this case, they mobilize the military and move into the site and then crack down right there. Before they get a chance to spread and get a chance to go hand in hand with the intellectuals. So they're so quick. They said they have to suffocate all the social unrest at its embryonic stage. That's the original word. So, yeah, we know what we're talking about. We know what we're looking at. But the signs aren't there yet, because they know it too.
Okay, please.
May I have a question?
Last question, because the time is running out and we will have to
do so.
So your first and second last questions, okay? Thank you.
About these opposition activities, are the chiefs of median companies active too in the fight for freedom, democracy?
The media company?
Businessmen, chiefs of median companies, only business?
No. They're very timid. They want no part of it. Except for one exception. Back in 1989, the largest computer company in Beijing, Sitong, the owner of Sitong got involved in the 1989 incident, who donated money, huge money, and he asked his cadres to take part. And now he fled. He's now living in France for more than 20 years right now. His name is Wan Renlan. Some of you might know him. So the answer is no. No, they're very timid. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Please.
What do you think if China falls apart as the Soviet Union, if the regime collapses, is going to fall apart or divide in some smaller parts like Mongolia, Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang or Tibet?
We don't know yet. Again, you're asking questions into the future. I wish I could see that. But I can respond a little bit. Like I said, in out of the Eastern European and the Soviet cases, there are Czechoslovakia who divided in two peacefully, and for Soviet Union, semi-peacefully into 15 in a matter of a year or two. And for the German case, they united to one. So, and for the Yugoslavian case, they're divided into six by now. So it seems to me that the country which were forged by force, by external force, especially exercised by Communist Party, would eventually break up when this holding force breaks up itself. Okay? But for those countries who were one originally, who remain pretty much one, Czechoslovakia, maybe one exception. So I would have to look into the Czechoslovakian case even further to answer that question. But my guess is probably not, because China has been like that for over 100 years, 200 years almost. So I don't see that, but I cannot rule out the possibility altogether. I want to leave myself an out, just in case.
So thank you very much. Anyway, the topic of collapsing communism and the transformation into a democratic society is quite very familiar and very popular here in the Czech Republic. And let's hope that Professor Chan will have some next opportunity to come again and we may continue this interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all.